When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. To make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I'm a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think, I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Hi there. A little over a week from now, thousands of scientists, economists, technologists and political leaders will gather in the United Arab Emirates for the annual Conference of the Parties, or COP meeting, on climate to assess where we are and what needs to be done. That's what we're going to be talking about this week on Democracy Sausage with a couple of excellent guests, Professor Jeanette Lindsay and Dr. George Carter. I'm Mark Kenny, and across from me here in the ANU studio is my friend Dr. Maria Teflaga. Hi there, Maria.
Hi, Mark. Hi, everyone.
Now, careful listeners to this program will remember Professor Jeanette Lindsay, who is a climatologist from the ANU's Fenner School of Environment and Society in the College of Science. She gave us an excellent overview of how the global climate system functions, the role of ocean currents, pools of warm water that can form, and all the things that can cause havoc in the global environment. Also with us, I think for the first time actually on Democracy Sausage at least, is Dr. George Carter, who is Deputy Head of the Department of Pacific Affairs at ANU. He's also Director of the ANU Pacific Institute, and you've probably seen him on The Drama or one of those sorts of programs. Welcome to you both.
It's good to be here.
Alpha, thank you very much.
So, George, you're heading to the United Arab Emirates for this COP meeting. I've attended these. They're enormous events. They can also be enormously disappointing at times, and there's often a lot of good intentions, but there's a pattern we really see as well where those intentions don't always manifest in sufficient action, and that seems to be the message that's coming out around this one. Briefly tell us what it is that you're going to be doing there, what role you're playing at this meeting.
Thank you for this opportunity. So the research I look into here at ANU is the diplomacy of these mega conferences or multilateral negotiations. I'm fascinated in how countries, states, parties, as well as stakeholders like private sector, NGOs who attend these mega conferences help to build and reach global consensus on climate change. By this, I look at not how they make agreement, but I look at the processes and relationships of how the states agree not to disagree, because that's essentially what these mega conferences are. It's a global negotiations in trying to find ways to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions, build climate action, but at the same time, build a vision for the future with the catastrophic impacts of climate change we have. And so I specifically look at these diplomacy of these states. So I attend these meetings really much as a research broker, both as a researcher, but also as a policy negotiator. Support. Mm. So my research looks at Pacific states, but also now increasingly more, especially with a possible Australia-Pacific bid, of how the role of a presidency from this part of the world can articulate and create a consensus. But on the flip side, I provide, as part of what's known as the One Crop or One Council of Regional Organizations Pacific, the only academic within this group of about 30 to 40 technical experts that support Pacific countries. So we provide negotiation training, but also thematic training throughout the whole year. And then we provide real-time support. So we are the people behind the scenes in terms of the strategies for the Pacific, supporting leaders, political champions from the Pacific, technical negotiators, and global campaigns on the Pacific at these meetings.
It's an enormous responsibility.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it keeps you very busy. And so just tell our listeners, what's the name of the group that you're going to support in the UAE now?
So One Crop, or One Council of Regional Organizations, are the group of technical experts from around the Pacific. And they
that's the acronym, is it? One Crop.
One Crop.
Yeah, that's quite clever.
Yeah.
Well, that's acronyms for you. They're meant to be, I guess.
And it support countries in three pronged ways. So there are 14 countries from the Pacific party to the negotiations. So one end is supporting technical negotiators, and they come under a coalition called Pacific SIDS, or Small Island Developing States. They sit also within the Alliance of Small Island States. So that's 14 countries plus the other countries from the Caribbean and the Indian Ocean, makes up a block of 54 countries. They sit inside the G77, or the Global South of 138 countries. So that's sort of the technical support. But we also support political champions. So there are 8 ministers and prime ministers from the region who have been, they themselves nominated themselves to be head of thematic areas. And we provide sort of the technical speak to learn how to do climate speak, be confident in front of the camera,
right,
be confident in these negotiations. But also, they are necessary at the very last few days of negotiations. Leaders are needed because there will be settings where it cannot be concluded as a technical, and it moves up to a political level. And so these leaders are trained. So throughout the year, this has been part of the work, collaborating with the, not directly with the ministers, but their offices in turning, but the support is there. And the third part is the pavilion. So there's one united pavilion called the Moana Pacific Pavilion. And this is in collaboration with the government of New Zealand. And it's the home of Pacific NGOs, private sector, to carry out. This year, we have 92 side events, showcasing, but also advocating not only the solutions, but the challenges of climate change in the region. And this is where academics, private sector, civil society, and local community indigenous people are able to share that story. Now, this year will be the first time in collaboration with Australia that will be next to each other. This is part of building that momentum to a possible Australia-Pacific bid. So now we are working with the Australian government in terms of how to collaborate, sharing that message. How do we weave that momentum into moving forward to hopefully bringing that COP to this part of the world?
Yeah, so that's what the bid is, the attempt to have a COP meeting. When would that, is there a target year?
2026, so COP31, 2026.
Right. And I guess there's this enormous, this goes to a couple of things you said really, but there's enormous sort of moral leverage that the Pacific countries have in and investment they have in the success of this program. So it's pretty important work, and it would be a major way of getting the world to focus on the effects of climate change in this part of the world, the differential effects on it, of having a COP meeting in this region. So Australia and you mentioned there that Australia and New Zealand and the region will be in partnership for the first time. Does that reflect the change in Australia's position in the Pacific generally? We saw the Prime Minister there recently. We know climate change, the rising sea levels and these sorts of issues are just absolutely central to not just to the existence of many of these low-lying Pacific nations, but also central to Australia's leadership or credibility in the region as a key and constructive player. So presumably that all plays into to this idea of launching a bid for this COP meeting in 2026.
The possible COP31 2026, because we will know in the next week or so.
So that will be decided at this meeting?
It will be announced.
Announced.
It will be announced.
Right.
Because there are other countries also with their hands up. But Australia and Pacific have a very strong case for this announcement. But it's an anomaly for international relations. It's the first time that a region plus a country will be hosting or chairing the presidency of negotiations. You usually have two countries. So you're pulling together your diplomatic assets in bringing that together. The other part that we also should look at is an acknowledgement and what we've been working on for so many years, that the climate conditions in this part of the world is shared, and climate impacts and how we respond to it are shared in terms of how Australia responds to disasters and humanitarian assistance in the Pacific. But we've also seen how Pacific states have also responded to the bushfires in Australia. We do know and we acknowledge that this is a shared result, but we also take into account that there's an anomaly, because you have one of the biggest economies in this part of the world, which is also, you know, dependent on coal and minerals, as well as Papua New Guinea. But you also have local atoll nations, which are at the forefront of sea level rise.
Yeah.
So it's a huge diversity, also huge diversity in terms of economies.
It's a huge, diversity is a polite word. It's a huge contradiction, isn't it, in some ways?
Well, others would say divergence in policies. So it makes it that very interesting diplomatic experiment in how you try and piece together coherence inside the presidency, and then how you object that in terms of building that diplomacy with a diverse set of nations, the 198 parties. So that's my fascination as an international politics researcher, and how you build that anomaly within multilateral system of the presidency, and now how you conduct that. But at the same time, negotiators very and leaders understand the differences of national interest that these countries have in terms of, it's not just a climate environment decision, it's also a political economy decision.
Yeah.
And how we balance that in terms of the presidency, and how that's balanced in terms of the negotiators, is what the other fascination is. Because at one side, countries from the Pacific, we say, always argue the extreme in terms of environmental integrity, pushing greater action. But you also have a country like Australia who acknowledges the fact that it has an economy that it needs to grow and that it will grow, but also wants to be a global leader in climate change. And so partnering with countries from the Pacific, I believe that diplomacy of amplifying that voice is also another way to see how this COP 2026 would look like.
Yeah, I suppose it's a surprise in a way to be having COP26 even in the UAE. So obviously some of these discussions, they're complicated, and they're complicated by geopolitical questions, money.
Absolutely. I mean, countries like Egypt last year and Sharm el-Sheikh, as well as this year UAE, many observers would say, and many NGOs are not attending in boycott of the fact. We understand that for those of us who follow COP meetings every year, these are countries trying to slow down the progress in slowing down climate action. But it's also, when you speak to leaders from this country, they also said, we acknowledge climate change. We see that we need to do work or build greater action and ambition. But at the same time, it's also fascinating to see the tactics of what they bring into the agenda. So you'll see in this year's agenda, it ranges from everything from renewable energy, incorporating conversations or dialogues on security, but it stays away from the point in conversation or negotiations that should be all about is greater ambition and greater action in terms of cutting greenhouse gas emissions, greater targets. But the tactic here with this year and the last year is bringing everything else, encouraging everything else except the most important parts of what's needed to be discussed. And so some of the strategies that the Pacific go into and say, that's great, but let's focus on climate adaptation, let's focus on mitigation, and let's focus on loss and damage.
Yeah. George, the agenda-setting power of the presidency is, you know, I think, very evident. Like, we can just think about when the UK hosted it, the sort of centrality that, you know, Boris Johnson placed on that, and the sort of policy achievements, I suppose, made at that COP. And so I guess what I really want to know is, what's the origin of this structure? Why has COP been structured in this way, with a sort of roving presidency, rather than a sort of, I guess, a UN structure that we're more familiar with, you know, of a standing committee, for example?
Oh, well, it's actually part of, in part, a UN sort of rule in terms of the president's moves around the five region. So currently we have UAE as the Asia Pacific seat. And then next year, when it moves back to Eastern Europe, right now we don't know where it is because of the war in Ukraine, but most likely could return back to Germany if Eastern Europe is not stable enough to host. And so it is one of those UN procedures that was accepted when the COP for climate change was agreed to back in 1992, 1995. So one of those procedures that the president would move around.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, at one level, it sort of seems obvious that it's about the sort of emergency and inherently global nature of the problem. And so it's giving it its own structure. But as to the question is, you know, the element of your question about the host nation having disproportionate power to, you know, influence the agenda, that's a bit more mystifying, isn't it?
I mean, I suppose on one level, like, it's just sort of classic diplomacy or, yeah, you know, international politics. But I guess as someone who is not across either the climate science or international negotiations as much as our guests, that is actually something that I've always actually wondered as to why it is that this process is governed the way it does. And it certainly helps to explain its relative successes and its relative, failures. And I really liked your construction, George, of basically agreeing to disagree, which I assume what you mean by that is to keep these talks going, right? Because it's a slow process, which I imagine must be quite frustrating for many activists and climate scientists, right, as you both are.
And people who live in the low-lying Pacific nations.
Indeed, who actually don't have endless amounts of time.
Can I tell a little story related to what you just said?
Of course.
This is something that has really stuck with me. I attended the COP in Copenhagen.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
Were you there? Yeah. Oh. So I took a class of students there and from ANU, and that was an incredible experience for everybody. Everyone found it transformational, actually, and it's been amazing to see what those people have gone on to do since Copenhagen. However, yeah, the story that I wanted to tell was that I remember being in one of the sessions where everyone's together and all countries are represented in the room. And I was observing that, and we had observer status as an academic institution. And a young woman from one of the Pacific Island nations stood up, and I can't remember which country she was from, but I think it might have been Tuvalu. And she stood up and she said, "I was born in 1992, and that was the year of the Rio Earth Summit, at which the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change came into being and started its journey, very slow journey." She said, "I was born in 1992. You've been negotiating all my life." And what has changed? The situation is worse now than it was then. That's a paraphrase.
Yeah.
But that has really stuck with me because it encapsulated the glacial pace of what's being achieved. I'm not denying the importance of these international negotiations. I think they are incredibly important to keep the world focused and talking and engaging.
They're all we've got, actually.
But at the same time, well, it's not all we've got. There's other things below the fully global level of the COPs, but maybe we can talk more about that if you want to. But for me, the fact that it is so slow and that it work on a consensual basis. So theoretically, all countries have to agree on whatever is decided at the COP. The COP chair can declare something decided even if there is some dissent in the room, I know, but George would be more of an expert on that than I am. But, you know, that is the thing that is just so hard to swallow, because in the meantime, decades have passed in which we could have been taking decisive action as a global community, and we have not.
Well, it raises an interesting question, George, and that is the extent to which, and sort of combining the last two points that have been made, the extent to which these COP meetings are kind of characterized by a lowest common denominator, by a sort of by the resistance rather than the initiative forces within each successive meeting. So that, you know, countries that are not prepared to agree to certain things for reasons, and everyone argues there are differential effects on their economy, they've got different reasons why they can or can't do certain things. And so you end up with this lowest common denominator rather than the kind of ambition that the science objectively tells us is critically needed.
Absolutely. And that's the anomaly of not just multilateral climate change, but other multilateral forums that use consensus as a decision-making. Because there are other bodies that you have unanimity voting to make decisions. But in this case, the anomaly here is that you want everyone involved to you want to pull an economy. So under Kyoto Protocol, which was the...
I like the idea of merging the two words. I think that's good. Kyoto Call. That's going to take off.
Under Kyoto Protocol, we had a compliance system, right? And so we had some movement there. But now with the Paris Agreement, it's all voluntary because we have a changing dynamics of countries in this time. Back in 1992, there were only a certain number of countries who were developed and had industries. Now, a country like China is the second biggest polluter, and we need them to make targets and cut their emissions. Yeah. And so suddenly we've got
need
decision.
Their buy-in to
we
the
need
process.
Their buy-in,
yeah.
As well as India and South Africa, Indonesia. We need them to make targets to also be a part of. And that's part of that compromise that was agreed to in Paris that... And it makes multilateralism even more frustrating, but even more needed because that's the system that there is now. As you said, if we don't have it, that's the best global. Of course, we have G20. We have, regional discussions that, like the EU, that sets ambitious targets. But we also need everyone to do something. And for countries, small countries, which you may say have very small influence in international politics, this is the main forum that it actually has a big voice and a big influence, in terms of country, but also local communities. Mm. Gives them that platform to speak out and also suggest, international mechanisms or push environmental integrity to get us closer to the middle or somewhere where we choose not to disagree. But yes, of course, that's why it's so slow in terms of action. But at the same time, I'm also fascinated with the relationship because of following these diplomatic relationships year after year. You can see in terms of the movement of Australia, back when I first started looking at Conference of the Parties back in 2015 in Paris, back then Australia and United States wouldn't even talk about loss and damage, right?
That's true.
Now, we're talking about a mechanism or funding mechanism for loss and damage. It would have been great if they agreed to 2015. But it's also great to see the movement in terms of coming forth. And so that's another fascination is not just looking at what I call transactional consensus, but the relationship consensus. And that's very important now in international relations.
Right, and that's because the bargaining proposition has changed. Like you've sort of said, you got all these extra actors, but I suppose you also have all of these different kinds of forums, and so it's actually a multi-level game, isn't it? Like some of it is to get specific outcomes in whatever, like the communique or whatever it's called at the end of COP, but I suppose a lot of the lobbying goes on is to get the G20 to agree to this or the EU to agree to that, which will increase the pressure on COP25 or 6 or 27, which will be next year somewhere in Eastern Europe / Germany. Okay, that makes a lot of sort of sense. So it's sort of like a small, it's like a rolling ball, but it's actually across multiple fronts all at the same time.
Absolutely. And so the research, while I focus on Pacific countries, is also fascinating what happens in other spaces. So you have the UNGA Climate Summit, you have the G20, you have APEC, and you find that climate change is now inserted into those major forums to try and get some action. And everyone at COP, who comes to COP at the end of the year, and that's part of it being at the end of the year, there's a series of meetings and informal conferences that try and build that target. the people that are part of the inner core group of negotiators from key countries who are part of COP also follow this in everywhere. They're also in G20. They're also inside APEC. They're also, because they're pushing for key language to try and get there, to try and get this on the board in terms of the declarations that come out of, or lack of declarations. But at least there's the negotiations is not left to the last 2 weeks of the year. And it's carried out throughout the whole year.
Yeah, and sort of woven in. Let's take a quick break and be back in a moment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Now, I should just say, Maria, you said COP27, I think.
Yeah.
So actually, 28, this one, right?
So, well, there you go. Yeah. So the next one will be 29.
Yeah. Is that right? 29. Yes. And 26 is 30, which is it? Or 26,
2026.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're great on numbers.
We're
here.
Really good at counting, yeah, everyone. Yeah.
It should be called arithmetic sausage.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not good at it. Now, look, let's get to, I guess, what lies underneath all of this, Jeanette, which is the climate itself, yeah, and the problem we have with the climate. And as you say, you used the term before, the glacial pace of it, which is sort of a good ironic term, really, because we're losing the glaciers as a result of this inaction. The last Friday, I think it was, the global temperature was said to have gone over 2 degrees for the first time. Now, this doesn't indicate that the world's at 2 degrees higher than industrial, you know, since industrialization. But it's the kind of thing you would start to see happen as you approach that kind of thing. So we are in a very desperate situation. The UN Environment Program has said that there needs to be much more dramatic action to get to 1.5. We're probably losing that already, and that we need to get to the sort of, I think, 42% cuts in global emissions to have any chance of staying inside 2 degrees, I think. It's an extraordinary emergency in a way, and it's an emergency that we're kind of, you know, as we've been discussing in the first half, that we're just sort of creeping up to and shimmying around and doing all kinds of things other than actually addressing it head on. So, just I'll throw it to you. Where are we with the global climate now?
Well, where we are, I agree with you actually in calling it an emergency, and I'd like to say something about that, but I'll park it for a second to answer your question. Global temperatures up until this year had risen by 1.4 degrees from pre-industrial times, right? So 1.4 degrees is kind of the background to what we've seen happen this year. This year has been extraordinary.
Yeah.
2023 has been just off the charts, literally, in a sense,
and it's
in that we've seen records broken, yeah, where it is expected to be the hottest year on record,
yes,
on average for the year.
Mm-hmm.
And now that is largely in due to what's happened in the Northern Hemisphere over the Northern Hemisphere summer, where we saw August, the hottest August on record, September, hottest on record, October, hottest on record. Now, Northern Hemisphere has gone into autumn and are heading towards winter, and the Southern Hemisphere is now moving into the hot season. Mm-hmm. Because the Southern Hemisphere is much more largely oceanic than the Northern Hemisphere, and the ocean takes in a lot of heat but moves it around and moves it deeper and so on. It doesn't express at the surface to the same extent.
Right.
We're not going to see those same extremely high temperatures in this Southern Hemisphere summer that we saw in the Northern summer this year. But what we do have on top of that is an El Nino event. And one of the absolutely extraordinary things about what's happened this year so far is that the El Nino event itself, which involves warmer than average water in the Pacific and usually raises global temperatures by some fractions of a degree, which is quite noticeable. The hottest years on record have been El Nino years in recent decades. What is extraordinary is that the highest global temperatures associated with El Nino events occur in the year after the event starts. These events start around June, July, and then they progress through a series of development phases. They usually peak around December, January, and then they start to taper off. And by April, May, they're over. And that's always the way they work because they're tied in with various seasonal cycles in the atmosphere and the ocean. Right. So we would expect the highest temperatures to actually be next year, given that history, rather
than something to look
this
forward
year.
To, yeah.
So the fact that we've seen these extraordinary temperatures is not only attributable, and in fact, it's not even largely attributable, I don't think, to the development of the El Nino event in the Pacific. I think we're going to see the impact of that next year. And this year, what we've seen is the planetary system responding to what is effectively a very large kick, which is the fact that we've got global temperatures rising to 1.4 degrees above pre-industrial, and that rise accelerating in recent decades due to the greenhouse gases accumulating in the atmosphere and all of the land use change, land clearing, deforestation, and all the other changes that we've made to the Earth's surface.
Right, so it's a ramping up of the negative feedback loop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're actually positive feedback.
No, I know, but in my mind, they're psychologically negative.
Psychologically negative.
But yes, it is positive because it's going up and not backwards.
Oh, no, absolutely. And it is accelerating. And the other thing that, you know, I think is important to realize is that scientists like myself have been telling the world through our research and through the talks we give and so on that this is coming, that this is what we expect to see with global heating ongoing in the way that it is. But these are amongst the scale of impact that we weren't expecting to see just yet. You know,
so your models were more conservative.
They were more conservative. And the fact that we're exceeding what was expected at this early stage, and it is a relatively early stage in the way we'd understood how the planetary system might react, that is very concerning. Because while we wouldn't expect every year from now on to be like this year, of course not, it's extraordinary and extreme, we would expect this type of thing to occur more and more frequently as the world continues to heat. Because it's going to. Greenhouse gas emissions still rise.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and the UN Environment Programme says in a report that's just come out in the days leading up to this COP28 meeting, makes the point there's no person or economy left on the planet that is going to be left unchanged by climate change. And even in the most optimistic scenario, the likelihood of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees, which was certainly the Paris target, right? It says, the organisation says, there's only a 14% chance of actually achieving that now from where we are. So
Absolutely.
This is sort of being fumbled in real time.
It is being fumbled in real time. And, you know, one of the things I've been reflecting on is that now for, since at least 2000 and possibly before, there's been messaging around this being the critical decade. We're in the critical decade in the 2000s in which decisive action and effective policies and targets and deadlines need to be in place to reduce emissions and phase out fossil fuels. Then it was the 2010s.
Yeah.
Now it's now, and I noticed that the UN Secretary General is talking about this is the critical decade, we have to get it right. And while I applaud that general messaging of urgency. I think the critical decade is not urgent enough.
Well, it sounds like it actually passed and now it's like clean up now.
Well, I think it's the critical year. I don't think it's the critical decade.
And there's problems with it sort of from a messaging point of view because, you know, obviously you can't change the past, so you're always talking about what you can do from where you are now, right?
Sure.
So that part, the psychology of that is understandable. But the ongoing claim that you are at the you know, the moment of crisis, and then a year later, you're even closer to the moment of crisis and so forth. I mean, that's literally true, but at the same time, it starts to become, you know, boy cried wolf type thing in a lot of people's minds. Exactly. You know, you said that last year and we're still here sort of thing. Yeah. And politicians, cynical politicians, have traded on that. The whole campaign, the whole project against addressing climate change has been about weaponizing that doubt, weaponizing that sort of you know, the kind of rhetoric, using it against it and saying, well, you know, look, everything's not as bad as they say and so forth.
Well, it's ongoing.
Yeah.
And I think there's a factor in there of sort of fatigue on the part of the audience that one's talking to as well. You know, disaster after disaster, pressure after pressure. It intrigues me that the world was capable of pulling together, accepting draconian measures, mobilizing vast amounts of money and working collaboratively internationally when COVID happened and achieved extraordinary things, achieved viable vaccines in less than a year, which was unheard of.
And what was the critical difference?
The critical difference, I think people were afraid they were going to die.
Precisely.
Immediately.
It was a here and now crisis,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And this has been the problem with climate change and the relationship between climate change and politics, climate change and economics, climate change and the ambitions of nation states and so forth, has been that this is a problem that is happening over the horizon all the time. Mm. And we are now starting to get these quite dramatic effects. I mean, Kenya at the moment is in the grip of deadly floods, lots of people dying, and this is on the back of an absolutely long-sustained drought, which is classic sort of, you know, kind of boom-bust cycle, much more volatile weather situations that you see that we were told to expect, and we're sort of seeing them play out now. Mm. And lots of people apparently are still in some level of denial about it. They always want to say that individual weather events aren't, you know, attributable to climate change, for example.
But that sort of attribution, I think, is being pretty or lack of attribution to climate change has been pretty comprehensively knocked on the head by the more recent science, which has been able to show just how many times more likely a particular heat wave or a particularly flood-prone period or delay of the Indian monsoon or whatever extreme bad fire season has become is now because of the underlying signal of global heating.
I mean, you're right.
So
right.
That's being done.
Yeah.
That's true. But
I mean, people still are, as you say, they're weaponizing this information.
People just don't understand probability. That's why people gamble.
Don't.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, if more people understood probability, you just wouldn't see people gambling at the same rate that they would because it's a losing proposition.
Well, it's why people smoke, frankly.
Well,
it's that same sort of thing,
precisely,
right? The problem's down the track.
I mean, there's actually, if you think about it, I mean, I don't know, but I'd be willing to guess that the number of people that have actually died from a climate-related cause probably far exceeds COVID, especially if we start counting from 2010. If we just think about, you know, the impact of climate on wars, the impact of climate on food systems, on flood systems, but also like in Western democratic countries where you don't experience wars, like just the number of people dying from heat stroke and other related diseases. And none of this is part of our public discourse. Instead, our public discourse is about small modular nuclear, which has not been built anywhere in the world and is a red herring and a fantasy and a distraction.
Yeah, modular news as well in a sense, which
Indeed.
Is sort of compartmentalizing these stories rather than seeing the pattern. I mean, you mentioned before the Indian monsoon. Last year, I think it was, Pakistan, a third of the country or something was underwater.
Yes.
I mean, this was...
For months.
Yeah. And this is a catastrophic event of, you know,
Absolutely.
Huge dislocation, deaths and so forth. I heard some statistics in the last week. I can't quote them exactly now, but it was a terrible figure for the level of malnutrition of Pakistani youth.
Mm.
And some of this is directly attributable to all of that land agriculture lost and the suffering dislocation associated with those weather extremes with that flood and other things. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, the suffering caused, the deaths and suffering caused by climate change, climate events, easily dwarf everything else.
And I think, you know, something else that we need to bear in mind is that the emissions that are the reason why we have this accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that is trapping heat and causing the temperatures to rise, it's basically disturbed the Earth's energy balance.
Mm.
Normally, you know, without all of this going on, without us, there would be a balanced system which maintained Earth's temperature in a viable for the type of life that we have situation for millions of years, many millions of years. Now we're in a situation where humans have intervened to the extent that we have altered that balance. We've increased these gases in the atmosphere that is trapping heat that would otherwise be exiting through the top of the atmosphere and keeping the whole system in balance. So it is out of balance. And that's why I
referred... forming a new equilibrium.
And we're not in a new equilibrium.
But it's, we don't even know where we'll land, right? But that's what we're actually doing.
And that's where, when you talk about, you know, a 1.5 degree target or a 2 degree target by the end of the century, what we're actually saying is that we want the temperature to stabilize at 1.5 or 2 degrees or whatever level
and
the end of the century. And that's the new equilibrium, so that there will be occasional small overshoots and occasional small drops below that. But that's going to be the new equilibrium.
And does the modelling show that you can have something approximating a functioning equilibrium at that increased level? I mean, can you, for example, dial up the temperature by 2.4 degrees, let's say, and say you could stop it there?
Yeah.
Does the modelling suggest that you wouldn't have such volatility in the system that there'd be sort of chaos effect?
No. You would still have the new equilibrium would include greater extremes and volatility than we've seen up to now, except perhaps for this year, which is a sort of forerunner, a harbinger of what we're facing if we go that far. That becomes kind of the new normal.
Right. But the new normal would involve the kinds of... So
the new normal is not...
But the new normal, precisely, because it would involve the kinds of hurricanes and cyclones and extreme weather events that we see now dominating the news in ways that they didn't used to, just because of their frequency and their severity.
That's right.
Which, George, goes to this whole loss and damage thing you mentioned before. Tell us about what that mechanism is and why that is now back on the agenda.
Yeah. But I also wanted to point here that new... new normal is catastrophic for some communities.
Yes.
Like communities in local Aotearoa nations like Kiribati, Tuvalu, Marshall Islands, Maldives, but also Miami, you know, in parts of Bangladesh, that sea level rise will actually inundate land in these places where they are actually living, growing agriculture.
That's right. And it does mean that some other areas, even irrespective of whether they're low-lying or not, will become more arid, and other areas, you know, and these might be areas that at the moment produce...
Our food bowl,
right? Yeah.
That new normal also is one of the reasons why you have loss and damage, the push to start thinking of a mechanism that looks at where adaptation can no longer be possible in land or on sea for these communities. And that the only thing to do is migrate or relocate. And some of these movement to relocate into inland or thinking of relocation to other countries is what this idea of the mechanism that loss and damage will help support.
And crudely put, and I'm sure you'll put this better, but it's essentially the industrialized world paying for some of this, like paying into a fund so that those developing countries that are severely disadvantaged, as you say, massive dislocation and so forth, that fund can be used to address those problems.
So that's what's been happening this year in terms of the dialogue and negotiations around the transitional committee to find out where that funding can come from, the modality and how it will be dispersed, and how countries will sort of take this on, and what are the issues. we've identified this as we need to do something about loss and damage. This was actually introduced back in 1992 when the UNFCCC was drawn up, but it was only picked up in Paris. And what it is that vision looking forward that we will be living in a world where we do need funding that is not adaptation, but funding for communities, especially local communities, because it won't be full states. It will be local communities can have access to the fact that they'll have to move. And that's what this idea of the loss and damage. But at the moment, we're still out. We haven't decided on where it will come from, how will be dispersed, which mechanism, will it be with the World Bank or will it be a new institution altogether? So the Transitional Fifth Committee have completed that negotiation and they're putting it to COP28, Dubai. Many countries want to rip it apart and start all over, but that's the strategies of these negotiations. Mm. But countries from the Pacific and are pushing for, no, it's time to get this up and running.
And, you know, there was a move a few years ago. And I'm not an expert on this. You'd know more about it, George. But I know that there was some talk about perhaps having all 198 countries represented at a COP, you know, wasn't leading to rapid action, the sort of rapid action that we need. Maybe we should be limiting these talks to the countries that are the most responsible for emissions, which are basically the industrialized countries. And that effectively the G20 and a few others. So that's an idea, but you know, to me and to a lot of other people, and I'm glad to see that we still have the COP in its entirety, the role of groups like the small island states, for example, has been absolutely crucial because without having this forum where the countries of Africa most affected, yeah, the countries of the Asia Pacific most affected,
yeah,
the countries of the Indian Ocean,
yeah,
etc., can get together with a voice that is powerful in a forum where they must be heard, that is almost too easy to ignore,
yeah,
by those with more economic clout.
Oh, well, they'll just create agreements that suit themselves and then congratulate themselves on the back for the progress they've made.
And, you know, it was the countries of the small island states that really pushed for the 1.5 degree target to be recognized in Paris. The talk prior to that had been, you know, 2 degrees is the target. That was actually decided in Copenhagen. I was in the room when the chair who was the then Prime Minister of Denmark, I might have got that wrong, he then went on to head NATO for a while. He said to this room of more than 2,000 scientists, well, you know, what are we negotiating for? Is it, you know, what's the target? What do we think is safe? Mm. The Framework Convention on Climate Change that the COP is based upon and around says, you know, limit warming to something that is safe. But it doesn't actually specify what that is because we didn't know in 1992. And in Copenhagen, we didn't really know either. And eventually there was this sort of pin drop moment where he said, you know, is it 2 degrees? And the room was sort of silent. And he said, okay, 2 degrees. So, you know, that's how we came to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, 1.5 is even that is not safe for many Pacific Island and Indian Ocean and Caribbean nations.
No, that's right.
They're still underwater.
Precisely. And I suppose the sort of the moral dimension of the global politics here is that Global South, developed nations are saying, hang on, so you want us to essentially pay for the costs of your lifestyle, of your improved living standards over the last century. You've industrialized, mm-hmm, you've changed the climate in the process. And now you're telling us what we can and can't do, and you're not even prepared to pay for it.
There was this whole idea of common but differentiated responsibility,
yeah,
that, you know, played out all the way through to Paris, where the developed countries were the ones with targets and the developing countries were not under the Kyoto Protocol.
And this is Morrison had a big problem with China in this regard, because of course China is a huge emitter, but still regarded as a developing economy.
Yep. And there were big problems with that. But how do you start? Where do you start? And I think, you know, the Kyoto Protocol, from my point of view, was a good start. The targets were lamentably tiny. And
even
never
then,
enough.
Australia negotiated
an increase rather than a decrease.
Yeah. Oh, ridiculous.
Yeah. Absolutely ridiculous. And unfortunately, for many years, Australia has in the negotiations played a blocking role in terms of progress on many aspects of getting things moving in the COPs. Hopefully we're past that.
Well, I was going to say that was what was in my mind when I was saying before about the lowest common denominator,
that nations
could sort of buy in and frustrate progress, slow things down
because
they perceived a disadvantage would accrue to them, and so that ended up being so in a sense, COP is like the art of the possible on steroids. You know, it's a sort of global version of that famous production of politics, and unfortunately, the problems just sort of getting closer and more extreme all the time.
Well, I mean, in some ways, the language we use is really important. Like in some respects, the problem is actually in the rearview mirror. You know, like we can already see what we have already done. And like language like a new normal, right? Like in some ways that's actually kind of comforting, a new normal, like, oh, okay, normal is my, you know. But really it's, we're talking about a new baseline.
Right. Yes.
Right?
That's,
you know,
true, actually. That's true.
Which variation will happen from. And your language of safety, I think, is a much more useful construction, because it's really not about normality. It's about the fact that, you know, the reality is that the human societies we have organized now will clearly not be sustainable in the same exact ways in 20 years' time or 50 years' time as they are now. We'll be living differently in different organized civilizations, and, you know, places that were, you could live in a certain way may not be possible to live like that anymore, because they're underwater, because they're too dry, because they're too wet.
Or too hot. Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So, and I agree with that. And I think language is extremely important. And, you know, I'm as guilty as anyone of probably potentially using the wrong words to describe things. But, you know,
it's,
I absolutely
difficult.
Agree.
It's really difficult.
I refer now to global heating. I do not talk about global warming or just climate change anymore. Warming is too it's a benign term.
Yeah.
And that's not what's happening. It's, you know, we are heating the planet, and we are heating it to unsustainable levels. The other thing that the other sort of area of language that I think has perhaps contributed a bit to some of the slowness of action has been around sustainability and resilience. You know, we have to adapt. We are already adapting to the impacts of global heating because we've had to. We've done it without necessarily even thinking about it. There's been enormous changes in Australian agriculture, for example, really innovative developments, very low water use for production of crops like rice, which are a water-hungry crop. But, you know, various strategies that have been implemented. Different forms of agriculture have moved to different parts of Australia because the conditions are not suitable. We heard, I think it was last week, about a large hazelnut growing enterprise in the eastern part of Australia that's being closed down by the makers of some of those things we like to eat, like Nutella and Ferrero Rocher and so on, because it's not viable long term to be growing that kind of crop in that area, and it's not a good investment, so they're pulling out. These sorts of changes are happening all the time, and we are adapting, and we will have to adapt much more as we go forward. One of the things, though, that I think is not logical or sensible, rational really, is this idea that it costs too much to make the changes we need to make. It will affect our lifestyle too much.
Well, this is the big deficit here in this argument all the way through,
exactly.
Isn't it? You know, people just not putting on the balance sheet what it costs not to adapt.
Whereas if we don't, the costs are so many times greater. The impact on the lifestyles of both ourselves as we get older and older and live longer potentially, and those of our children and their descendants and so on, will be impacted enormously by what we've set in train.
And we become, history will show, the generations that didn't care enough.
Yes,
didn't care enough.
Did not act fast enough when we could.
When we could. Now, we're going to have to wrap things up now. So I think we've probably been going a long time. This is such a fascinating conversation, and we could keep going, but I guess we'll obey the sort of, you know, the immutable laws of podcast logic and wrap it up about that. But it's been really terrific having this conversation, Dr. George Carter, Professor Jeanette Lindsay, and you, Maria, of course. Thanks, everyone, for that conversation. Let's hope that we see a some material steps forward in this challenge in the UAE in a week's time.
Absolutely.
Good luck, George.
Thank you very much.
Oh, yes.
That's Democracy Sausage. We'll talk to you again next week. Until then, bye for now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.